Jason, what inspired you to want to be an artist?
Well, it was never really like a conscious decision, I don't think. I mean, I've always drawn, I've always made stuff ever since I was a kid. As a teenager, I always hung out with artists and musicians. So, I mean, the only time I was ever really conscious, I guess, would be in my decision to go to art school and pursue it as a career. But at that point, I think I had already self-identified that way anyway, so it really wasn't a really big choice to make. I don't really know what else I would have gone to school for, I guess, if it would have been a bigger choice.
Where did you go to school?
I started off at the Art Institute of Boston in Boston, Mass. That's actually where I grew up, was Boston. And I started there because, you know, I had friends that had gone there. I had hung out there in high school. So I started off there, and then I studied abroad in Florence, Italy in 2004. And I actually met my wife when I was studying abroad in Florence. Then we came back. I dropped out of school, and we moved to New York City for a while. And then after a little bit, I transferred to Ringling School of Art and Design in Sarasota. So that's actually where I got my BFA, which that was a really great fit for me. It was exactly what I needed at the right time, and their reputation follows me everywhere that I go. And then now I'm in Buffalo. I just finished my master's degree at UB in 2011, which for me was the perfect follow-up to Ringling, because they have such a conceptually strong program, and Ringling really sort of solidified the tools that I needed to make the work, and UB really sort of helped me figure out what I wanted to do with it. So.
Can you talk about your experiences going through a Bachelor's of Fine Arts program? Like, what did you encounter going through both your BFA and then your MFA later on?
I mean, for undergrad, I kind of bounced around a lot. I started off as an illustrator at the Art Institute of Boston, and then I went to Florence and I was studying, you know, Renaissance art and that kind of stuff. And then I came back, and that's when I really sort of grabbed onto the figure and took off with that for a while. And then Ringling was a much different experience. I mean, AIB was an urban campus, and then Ringling, all of a sudden you're like out in Florida somewhere, and you're just surrounded by just nature, and all the campuses, all the classrooms are like these bungalows and out by the canals that they have out there. So it was a much different place to be, but at the same time, it was really funny because Ringling was much more in tune with what was going on now in the contemporary scene, and AIB was much more traditional. It's funny how the environments were sort of the opposite of that.
How important do you think it is for a graduate, or I'm sorry, how important do you think it is for a fine arts program to have an integrated awareness of contemporary art as well as traditional?
Oh, I think it's one of the most important things. I mean, essentially, you're learning to make art that this is going to be your career. You need to have some sort of idea of what's going on in the contemporary art scene. You need to be able to understand what's relevant. You need to understand how you fit into that relevance. You need to know what's going on with other people. You need to network. So I think the contemporary focus is really something that is vital in a contemporary program. I mean, I think it's also very important to learn the traditions and learn where they came from and why they were utilized at the time, and learn the practices so that you can apply them now. But I think without a contemporary understanding, it's very difficult to sort of make anything that's going to take off today that's relevant, really.
Did your program have much of a focus on the theoretical side as well as the technical side?
UB did, for sure. Yeah, Ringling dabbled in it. I mean, Ringling was always very much focused on making art in a contemporary setting, but from a studio perspective, whereas UB was much more about... I mean, it was still... I mean, I had a lot more studio freedom at UB, actually, than I did at Ringling, but I also spent a great deal of time in classrooms talking about contemporary issues and talking about work from modernism to this point now. A lot of focus on the 60s and the 70s.
Did you take any courses with Tony Conrad?
I didn't take any with Tony, no, but I did take some with, I took a few with Steve Kurtz, and I took one class with Jonathan Katz, who's the new director of the PhD program there. And that was a really interesting class to take.
Who are some of your most influential mentors throughout your education and throughout your artistic career?
There's a lot. I've had a lot of people that have been very supportive of my work and very helpful. One person that actually comes to mind, though, in terms of really making an impact was probably he was my last painting professor that I had at Ringling my senior year, Bradley Wester. And the reason he was so influential was because he hated everything that I did. He absolutely just despised everything that I was doing. And he was a really great teacher. His work was really good. He was really in tune with what was going on in New York. He was there on a 3-year fellowship that he was teaching there for 3 years. The rest of the time he's in New York. He was very supportive, but he was not afraid to tell me that everything that I was doing was crap. And you know, that was a really eye-opening experience for me at that time. And he really sort of wiped my slate clean my senior year of undergrad, which really just, you know, cleared the slate for UB. And so then when I came to UB, I was much more receptive, I think, than a lot of other people might have been. And I had a lot of great mentors at UB that really helped shape my work now and how I see what I'm doing and how it fits in with contemporary art. And particularly Joan Linder, she's been probably my closest mentor at this point. And then again, Steve Kurtz and Jonathan Katz really helped me sort of see things from a different perspective. And it was at the same time important for me to go through that interdisciplinary atmosphere that they have there as well. That really helped push my work into a different dimension, I think.
At Ringling, how did you respond to being told that what you were doing wasn't worthwhile? Like, how did you deal with that rejection?
It was just more motivation. I think it just pushed me that much harder to really sort of figure out what I wanted to do. And I mean, a lot of the issue is, you know, it's great that, you know, it's great to be able to paint, but you got to really figure out what you're going to do with it. Why are you making this? Why is it relevant? Why should anybody care? And so those were the issues that I really just tackled at that point. And if it weren't for that, I mean, you need to, one of the things he always used to say was you got to put rocks in your shoes. Like, you can't just, like, get comfortable with what you're doing and just stick with it. You got to be able to be uprooted from everything that you're doing and be able to figure it out all over again.
Are there any artists who have been very influential in your work?
Joan Linder's been exceptional. A lot of the people that I look at is, I like Cecily Brown. I look at John Curran a lot. Older people like Sargent was one of my very early on influences. I'm trying to think of her name. Chantal Joff, I look at quite a bit. There's one, of course, it's always the one person that I'm thinking of that I can't remember her name now. Oh, that's going to haunt me.
If you can remember it later,
I can edit it back in.
Can you talk a little bit about your art, what you create and why you create it?
Sure. I primarily work in painting. I also do sculpture and installation work. The paintings tend to be very rooted in the figure, and the sculptural stuff actually tends to be very rooted in sort of the absence of the figure. So I very much think of them as two parts of a whole. Both of which, you know, are centered around creating dialogue about how we do or don't interact with our everyday existences.
What sort of installations do you do?
The last installation that I did was for Fluid Culture. It was a raft that floated in the canal down on Canalside. It was a bed with an end table and a lamp. And I did another installation at UB for my graduate program, which was similar along the same lines, but it was a breakfast table with four chairs and a centerpiece, and all the all the table was all set with china and dishes, but nobody could eat there. And those installations were rooted in this idea of, they were rooted in the foreclosure crisis and the idea of how our relationship to our houses have changed. Yes, as society goes on and on, you know, we're sort of pushed into needing to earn more and more money to pay for more and more things, even though wages are going down and down and jobs are going down and down and funding's going down and down. And so a lot of it had to do with sort of this, you know, we work and we work and we work for these things that we're sort of expected to value, you know, a permanent home, you know, a steady job, health insurance, all these kinds of things that create these comforts and stabilities. But then at the same time, you know, we're in a society, and I have two kids, and we're in a society now where both parents have to work in order to be able to pay the bills, because one person's wage just doesn't cut it for four people anymore. And so you're always sort of like bouncing around from job to job and gig to gig, and you don't even really get the time to like to enjoy these things that you're so busy working to collect, you know. So it had to do with a lot of that, and it's, yeah, just the absence of presence.
Can you talk about the totality of your body of work and what are some different themes that have emerged, maybe specifically in your paintings and your sculptures?
Sure. The one thing that I'm interested in now is sort of the dichotomy between freedom and imprisonment and how those two concepts are not mutually exclusive. They're not necessarily opposites at all. They sort of flow around each other and are constantly in flux and overlap. So yeah, again, and I'm interested in how that plays on us psychologically within our everyday experience. So again, like, we're always, you know, I think every one of us, to some degree or another, are sort of stuck in this cycle of, one, we want to stabilize our lives. We want to have a steady job. We want to have insurance. We want to have, you know, enough money coming in on a regular basis to pay for the things that we need. We want to have a permanent home, you know, these things. And then at the same time, we also all, to one degree or another, want to sort of escape the banality of maintaining this American dream, you know? So we're constantly, you know, there's a certain degree of freedom that exists in having this stability, but then at the same time, it's imprisoning, and there's a certain degree of freedom to not having this stability, but then that's also imprisoning, you know? So a lot of it has to do with that. Housing comes in quite a bit as a regular motif, and that actually started again with the foreclosure crisis and the same sort of idea. That's actually where I sort of started down this path, because what was really interesting I found about the foreclosure crisis was that all of a sudden people were sort of stuck in their houses. They couldn't sell them because the value had gone down, and they were all of a sudden underwater. Their mortgages they owed more on their mortgages than their houses were worth. And so when we think of, I mean, I think when most people think of the foreclosure crisis, especially those that aren't directly involved in it, you know, everybody thinks of, oh, you know, the person that's, you know, having trouble paying their mortgage, but, you know, they just desperately want to hold on to their home. That's their home. They want to keep it, you know. But then at the same time, there was actually this whole slew of other people that wanted to get out of their houses. They wanted to get rid of them, and they couldn't. And, you know, they can't take new jobs. They can't progress in any way that requires relocation because they can't sell their houses. They're not worth the money that they owe on their mortgages, and their neighborhoods are deteriorating because everybody's foreclosing. And so there was this whole other problem that I don't think we'd really associated with housing up until this point. And so that's how I sort of got started on this dichotomy.
In contrast, what are some themes within your sculpture?
The sculptures, those actually are the more direct ones. Those are the ones that have had more to do with housing. So again, like the raft, you know, floating on the water is this sort of like intangibility, you know, this sort of fragmenting of the house into these various parts that are all sort of like floating away. It has to do with our sort of value of the house as you know, the American dream. That's the, you know, the absolute in terms of what we're supposed to be striving for, you know, says society. The paintings I tend to think about it in a more psychological and abstracted way. So for one example I can give you is one painting I did, Survival Pack. It was actually a painting of me, and I was wearing this backpack of ICU equipment. And that that painting actually came about when my grandmother actually got sick while I was in grad school, and she passed away. And we drove out to be with her when she passed. So, you know, I was there in the ICU when she died. But she died of heart failure, which is actually something that's on that side of my family is something that's very prevalent. My dad actually had a heart attack when he was in his 40s and passed away. And, my grandfather, my grandmother, everybody's died of heart-related issues. And, you know, it sounds so dramatic, but to me, I think the painting is funny because one of the things that I said to my wife when we were going through it was, you know, I should just hook myself up to this stuff now as a way to sort of prevent me actually having ever need it. You know, so for me, that's what I did in the painting. I made this backpack, but all the stats and, you know, everything that's there is of a healthy individual. It's not somebody that actually is sick. It's just somebody that's sort of trying to stabilize themselves and secure themselves and in a way to free themselves from worry of that being an issue later on. So he lugs this thing around wherever he goes, just in case, you know, but it actually just creates more and more burden and more struggle and more and more imprisonment. So.
Your works have a fantastic level of detail and attention to the figure, like you expressed, but in many ways you have no background whatsoever. You know, it is this flat background. Mm-hmm. How did you get to that conscious choice of, like, totally moving away from so many traditional structures within painting?
It's actually sort of a combination of a lot of different things. It was sort of a formal issue that I was dealing with when I came to it because I had already sort of obliterated the background in any sort of environmental sense, you know, and I was working with patterned backgrounds a lot. And that was just, as I was going on, that was causing more and more conflict, so I eventually just came to the decision to just obliterate the backgrounds completely. Parallel to sort of solidifying what I wanted to do conceptually, so it became, a lot of what I'm doing in the paintings particularly is psychological. So it's also sort of a way to remove the individual and the experience from the outside, from the everyday, from the environment, and sort of just put it in this isolated individual state.
Could you talk about your creative process and what you go through in the creation of your works?
Sure. Yeah, one thing that people, I think, actually find kind of funny, because I have such an attention to detail and I love to paint and draw, but I actually don't sketch. You know, I don't sketch at all. I never really have. Personally, I feel that when I sketch out an idea, it sort of brings all its flaws to the forefront too prematurely for me. So I don't sketch. I sort of let the idea sort of just brew for a while. I mean, I'll write down ideas so that I don't forget them, but in terms of, like, imagery, I don't like to create any real preliminary imagery because I sort of work through it in the painting itself and in my reference material that I create to make the painting, the maquettes, which I actually do in Photoshop. So what I'll usually do is, you know, I'll have the idea, I'll sort of come up with this image in my mind, but when we have the image in our mind, it's like a dream, you know, it's always like, it's real, it's solidified, you can envision it the way that you want it to feel, you know, but you don't have the access to just go in there and see, you know, the details of exactly how everything's positioned and exactly how everything's arranged. Whereas if I were to, you know, sketch out, you know, 20 different versions of an idea and then pick one, you know, you have this sort of, like, cemented idea. So what I'll do is I'll go and off. My wife's a photographer, so I take the credit for photographing it, but she actually helps me quite a bit photographing the elements that I want for my painting. And then I go into Photoshop and I collage them all, and I can sort of play off of the photographs and see how they work together, which works better for me. And that's my sketching, because if I draw it out first, then I'm trying to make the photographs fit into this already, you know, idealized version of how, you know, this is the pose that I want, and this is that. And so then I just, I work through it on Photoshop, and I like the, I like to collage them too, because I like the sort of, you know, I get that, I try to strive for that sense of realism with the, you know, the photo imagery, but then I like that the collage always has that sort of off quality to it. It's always, you know, touching reality, but also sort of just disjointed from it in a non-obvious way, so that it always feels a little bit psychological, but not, you know, it never really becomes real in a spatial sense.
What, if anything, do you hope the audience takes away from your works?
What do I hope they take away?
Or is there anything you hope to achieve with your art, you know?
Dialogue and interest, you know, the usuals. There, as far as, like, taking things away, like, I you know, I'm interested in these sort of socio-political ideas and how, you know, what's going on in the world and how things are relevant now, but I don't want to illustrate those things. I don't want to, like, sort of talk about them directly in a political way. I want to create these sort of psychological experiences that people can relate to, that they can sort of be like, yeah, I feel that way right now. You know, like, I don't, not like, oh, I know that's what's going on and I know this is how I should think about it or that's how I should think about it, but I just want to sort of capture, like, a mental space that I think myself and many other people are experiencing at this time.
Yeah, your works have a fantastic element of, like, that psychological surrealism.
Right.
To them. Let's see. And so you graduated from UB in 2011?
Yes.
And how long had you been pursuing your career in the arts at that point?
Well, I started my BFA in 2002, and then I, you know, did a few years and then studied abroad and then left for a little while and then came back and then took a year off. And so, I mean, I've been working all the way through, and but yeah, I mean, that's been the span of my career so far.
I'm asking that to lead into asking about what you've had to do throughout the past 10 years to advance your career in the arts.
You know, it's with art making, it's really, I mean, you really have to be self-motivated. I mean, I think that's the number one thing. I mean, there's so many people that graduate from art school nowadays, and jobs are so few in terms of, you know, I'm going to work here and they're going to give me my paycheck and I'm going to clock in and that kind of thing, in terms of art-related jobs. But I think that's the thing that just, you know, people, you know, they do these things when they're in school and they do these things when they have sort of an outside source pushing them to do it. But if you can't get out and do it yourself and have that drive to get to the next step and push yourself there, then that's really, I mean, that's really what sort of makes or breaks people, I think. I mean, in terms of, like, exhibiting, I just graduated with my MFA. I'm still sort of emerging in that sense. I was just published in New American Paintings earlier this year. I've done exhibitions nationally. I've done a couple internationally. You really just have to look for things, and you have to look for deadlines, and you have to look for shows and get to know people and network and push yourself. You just really have to be the one that's really, you know, driving yourself to do this.
When it comes to the shows you've exhibited in nationally and internationally, are these group shows?
Mostly, yeah. Okay. I mean, the only solo show that I've had up until this point is my thesis show at SIBA, which was last year.
Where did you find information about a lot of these exhibitions?
A lot of it is through people that I know. I mean, Buffalo has been very, very good to me in terms of that. I mean, I've been invited to do a lot of things here. As far as, like, exhibiting nationally and other places, it's at this point it's really just been open calls and applying to, you know, every time, you know, oh, here's this show and here's that show, we're looking for people, and then you apply and you either get it or you don't, you know. But even that, I mean, of a lot of things that way open up into newer things. So I applied when I was in grad school. I did a show in Chicago at the Zabi Art Center called Wet Paint. And then after I had done that show, Zabi Art Center contacted me and asked if I wanted to participate in an exhibition that they were doing that was going to be called Wet Paint China, that was traveling to a couple of art museums in China. Things build up that way. That exhibition actually hasn't happened yet because the Chinese government is sort of standing in the way from allowing it to go through. But nonetheless, I was invited. But things do open up and in that way. So
you're what we call a buffalo transplant.
Yes, yeah.
What are some of your needs? I guess this is a two-part question.
Sure.
What are some of your needs as an artist that the community can provide? And that I'd like to know your perspective on the Western New York community and perhaps some other communities you've been a part of,
right?
If there's anything different.
I mean, actually, honestly, one of the reasons that I've stayed here is because Buffalo is just a great city to be an artist in. I mean, yes, it does have its pros and its cons. On the pro side, you know, it's got a great art community. It's very, very cheap. There's a lot of space that you don't have to pay a lot of money to utilize. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of really great organizations that are, one, really established and attract, you know, very good artists from all over the place, but at the same time are also very willing to work with local artists and emerging artists. And so Buffalo is a really great supportive community. The one thing that Buffalo doesn't have enough of is money. That's the one thing that just, I mean, it, you know, you can be the cheapest place in the world, but if you've got nothing coming in, you can't make work, you can't do anything. So that's the one. There's not a lot of jobs, there's not a lot of funding.
So perhaps what other communities could or do provide is more financial opportunities for artists.
Yes. When I say that, I'm sort of, you know, thinking of New York, Chicago, LA, these places, there's a lot of galleries, there's a lot of art collectors, there's a lot of that kind of stuff that's going on. I mean, so I'm not expecting, when I say Buffalo doesn't have money, I mean they don't have money in that sense. Buffalo has a really great avant-garde sensibility and a really great avant-garde support system here, which is, you know, which I love, and that's one of the reasons that I'm here. The one thing that it lacks in terms of sustaining and building your art career to the next level is just the resources that places like New York and Chicago and LA have in terms of collecting and that kind of thing. They're making a push towards it with the Echo Art Fair and that kind of thing, but I mean, it's simultaneously sort of the thing that makes Buffalo so great and the thing that sort of just cuts it off right when it's about to get somewhere amazing, you know?
Have you looked into being represented outside of the region?
Not seriously. That's kind of... I'm getting to the point now where that's sort of my next step that I'm looking to... I'm looking to get gallery representation. But at the same time, I want to stay in Buffalo. I want to... Like, it's a great place to work. And it's a great place to show, too. I mean, there are community here. I don't want to sort of sound like it's not a great place to be an artist. It's a fantastic place. You do have to... I mean, part of what's great about being an artist now is that everything's so international, and you can be in Buffalo and apply to shows in New York or London or, you know, Berlin or wherever you want to exhibit. So, I mean, there is a much farther reaching, opportunities are much more farther reaching, I think. Mm-hmm. So you can really be anywhere.
Yeah, and, you know, nothing you've said hasn't been reflected in many other perspectives, both in these interviews and not, you know.
Okay.
One of the biggest challenges is really that there aren't any major dealers here.
Yeah.
You know, and there isn't that higher priced collecting sensibility. I mean, we have a couple local collectors, you know, and we have we have a really strong community of collectors here who aren't necessarily looking to buy contemporary work,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
and that's part of the...
Or they buy very much smaller stuff.
Right.
Much.
So you did kind of touch on this, but what is going to help advance your career to your next sort of goals for yourself?
Yeah, at this point, I think that the next thing that I want to do is seek out gallery representation. I think that's the next step. And I mean, you know, aside from that, just continuing to pursue shows in other regions as well. I mean, I will continue to show in Buffalo as long as I'm here and afterwards if I do end up relocating for whatever reason. Yeah, you still have to sort of keep expanding your umbrella in terms of who's aware of your work. And
you know, it's interesting. It seems that a lot of BFAs and MFA programs, there's a big discrepancy between how programs prepare artists to market their own work.
Yeah.
And what sort of experiences have you had with that in your programs that you've attended?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my biggest gripe with art school is just... And I think part of the reason is that, you know, because everything's so self-directed and self-motivated, so many different people go about it in so many different ways. So, I mean, you know, you might have one professor who's got gallery representation and does, you know, two-dimensional work that, you know, they have their show, people buy it. You know, you might have other conceptual artists that don't have anything tangible to purchase and you know, video artists and other things, and so they sort of build their career in a different way. But yeah, that's the biggest thing that nobody really wants to just go into and touch on. So a lot of it, you do have to sort of figure out for yourself. One thing that just came out was The Profitable Artist from NYFA. That was one book that was the first book that I bought when I graduated. After I graduated, and that was helpful. But at the same time, it's like when people do touch on things, it's still very sort of vague and very sort of on the surface. And like, oh, here's, you know, these things exist. There's grants and there's residencies and there's, you know, scholarships and publications and galleries and all these opportunities. But it's very, very difficult to get any sort of feedback on what's worth pursuing. And that's one of the biggest challenges that I find is that, you know, there's so many opportunities, there's so many galleries, there's so many artists that it's really difficult to sort of filter through what's worth it and what's not. So, I mean, like, you know, what residencies are really going to push me to the next stage of my career? What galleries are really going to represent my work positively? And a lot of these are, part of the problem is a lot of these things are, have a lot to do with what artists. I mean, certain artists fit into certain galleries better than other artists, and they fit into other, you know, they do festivals and things like that that fit them better. But it's just really difficult to sort of filter through what's beneficial and what's not beneficial. To get back to the question, I think, yeah, that's one of the hardest things in art school is to really get down to, because it's just such a subjective, amorphous topic. There's no one real way to do it, and so nobody wants to teach it one way. The best thing that I think most people can do is just talk to as many people as you can about as much as you can and show your work to as many people so that they can give you informed feedback as to where to look and who to look at. I mean, that's what grad school is really all about, I think, in terms of fine arts programs.
That partially answered the question I didn't ask, which was what advice you have for emerging artists, or maybe people who are either going into, you know, their BFAs and MFAs, or just getting out, a place that you're still really connected with.
Right.
It's recent.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest advice that I can give to emerging artists is to just pay attention and pay attention to what other artists are doing, pay attention to what's relevant, pay attention to what's being shown, And not that you should mold your work around what people want or what's hot at the time, but you have to be aware of where your work's going to be best received, who's going to receive your work. Basically, just if you create your work in a bubble and you're sort of looking at artists from such and such time period and not really finding a way to make it relevant to what's going on now, you know, your career is going to exist in a bubble.
Has collaboration been important to you?
Yes, it has. Most people wouldn't know me as a collaborative artist. I don't really do collaborative projects where, you know, this piece is by Jason Seely and so-and-so. But collaboration's always there. My wife Kristen's an artist, and we're always critiquing each other's work and feeding off of each other. And, you know, oh, I think you should organize your exhibition this way. And, you know, there's always collaborative elements to it. And again, I mean, even in terms of, you do have to be aware of what other artists are doing and talk to other artists and find out what they think of your work and tell them what you think of their work. And critiques are always a collaborative process, and critiques are one of the best gifts that you can have as an artist. There's nothing worse than making work and not really knowing what anybody thinks about it. You know? So, I mean, anytime anybody gives you any kind of feedback, positive or negative, it's always part of the collaborative process, I think.
Is there anything you wished you had known in 2002 that you know now?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I wish that I'd known in 2002 that I know now but didn't at the time. In terms of my art career, I mean, yes and no. That's such a tough question to answer, because so much of my work is based on personal experiences and my reactions to those experiences that, yeah, there's a lot of things that have been frustrating, or, you know, you're kicking yourself afterwards, oh, I wish I didn't do that, I wish I didn't waste my time on this, I wish I had done this differently. But at the same time, if you just get it right the first time, then it doesn't impact what you're doing in the same way that it does after you screw it all up, you know? So no, I don't wish there was anything that I knew in 2002 that I don't know now, because I don't think I'd be making the same work that I am now if I knew it back then.
Jason, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I mean, just, you know, thank you for giving me this opportunity to do this interview and be part of this pilot program. I'm really excited about it.
Thank you for taking part in the Living Legacy Project.
Great, thanks.